This podcast is offered by Jikoji Zen Center on the web at jikoji.org. Our programs are made possible by donations from people like you.
Trying not to kill the mosquito. Good morning, everyone.
Good morning. Good morning.
Welcome to Jikoji. Before we begin, I always like to offer a land acknowledgement to the Ohlone people. Can you hear me over there, everyone?
Yes.
Yeah? Okay. I'd like to offer an acknowledgement to the Ohlone people who are the native people of this land and of the entire Bay Area for over 10,000 years. They did not cede this land, they did not surrender it willingly. And I also like to point out that that kind of ceding of land and dissolution in some ways of people and their culture continues to this day. So it's nothing ancient. It's happening right now in Mongolia, in China, in Peru, in Brazil, in Tibet, and all over the world as indigenous peoples try to hold on to their culture and their language and their teachings. When any culture is diminished, we are all diminished. So if you feel inspired to help any group kind of maintain and remember their own traditions, please feel free to put your money where your heart is. And in particular, if you want to help the Ohlone people, there is a foundation. Just Google Ohlone Foundation and you can support them. This acknowledgement is not meant to induce guilt. It's meant to remind all of us. I'm going to need some water. If someone would please get me some. Oh my goodness. Thank you. Thank you. It's not to meant to induce guilt. It's to remind all of us of our interconnection and that if anybody anywhere is being diminished, we are all being diminished. So I thank the Ohlone people for taking care of this land so that we can continue in their wake taking care of this land. Thank you. I might go there. So at Zen centers all over the world, we talk quite a lot about the Buddha's first teaching, the Four Truths. Today, I'd like to focus our attention on the precursor to that teaching, all of his teachings, his 45-year career of teaching, by looking at and considering the story of his awakening. I first was exposed to, you could say, the Buddha's teaching in high school. I was 16, and I read Hermann Hesse's book, Siddhartha. It's not actually the Buddha's story, but it's close. It has its threads of similarity. I was 16 years old. It's a very tender age. It's maybe the first time we get a good whiff of how confused we are about who we are and how we fit in to the whole world. And the Buddha's awakening story has always been kind of a light in the darkness for me around that confusion. And for me personally, in my practice, something like a psychological map of how to live my life. So that's why it inspires me. So this is the basic story. After leaving home, literally shedding his former life, and then following many different teachers and mastering their teachings over a period of 6 years, Siddhartha Gautama, the Buddha to be, sits down under a Bodhi tree along the side of a river. And he says, I'm sitting here until I get to the root of suffering, the root of all suffering, which is to say the root of our suffering and his. Now, I will say that no one, of course, was sitting next to him, a scribe taking notes. What's happening now? And the story that comes to us was first written down like 300 years after his life, And as we will talk about a little later on, it was embellished much later by the Mahayana tradition of which we are a part. But the original narrative from the Pali Canon tells a story of three kind of shifts. He calls them watches, the Buddha. So the Buddha sat through three watches as part of his awakening. And they have, if you look it up, they have some times associated with them. I don't think he was wearing a watch, but later on, someone decided this is what the watch meant. So in the first watch, from about 6 to 10 p.m., he remembered his own past lives. In the second watch, from 10 to 2 a.m., he observed the cycle of death and rebirth and karma for all sentient beings. And in the third watch, from 2 to 6 a.m., he penetrated the truth of dependent origination and the cessation of suffering. You'll find out later, he says, cessation, cessation to his students. And then that led to his full awakening. As I said, later in his life, the Buddha taught his students, who are now, today, here, us, over and over again, he would say, the entire awakening is about cessation, 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 nirodho, nirodho in Pali. He is speaking to the complete stopping, the complete extinguishment of suffering. And that happened through the unraveling of its underlying causes, his own underlying causes. You can probably see why I think this is a psychological map. Excuse me. So, just like Siddhartha, we take our seats. I'm sorry, I just have this voice, and someone was kind enough to give me a lozenge, so I'm going to use it. This will be a first. I might sound funny. So, just like Siddhartha sitting down under the Bodhi tree, we too take our seats this morning under the oaks and the laurels and the Doug firs here at Jokoji. And we consider these three watches that Siddhartha sat through here in our own body and mind experience. You could say the first watch, when we first sit down, is we start reflecting on our lives, because all this material usually shows up when you sit down to practice. We see our actions and our inactions, everything with which we have engaged in our lives, everything to which we have been subject to in our lives. In other words, when we sit down with this array of selves to encounter, to meet, and an array of stuff we've picked up and identified as ours. So that's the first watch. The second watch is understanding how these various selves arise and pass away, how our actions have consequences, how what we do with our energy, with this life, matters. Sitting here, we can experience, for example, how generosity and awareness and selfless care create a particular kind of community or world, while harmful actions and self-centered grasping create a different kind of community and a different kind of world. That's the second watch. And then comes the third watch. This is where Siddhartha sees the origin and cessation, let's say, of his own suffering. He sees greed, hatred, and delusion. We call those the three poisons. He sees them and he recognizes the possibility and then attains freedom. In other words, he's able to let go of his suffering. So the third watch is where we also encounter how one thing conditions another, how suffering continues through generations, really, through a chain of causes, and how none of it exists independently of anything else. In our little quiet zazen here facing this wall, we each have a front row seat to our own mental links and unlinks. So in our Buddhist teaching, these links are called the 12 links or interdependent co-arising. I'll give you the traditional list, but then I'm going to give you a cheat sheet that somebody gave me one time that really works for me. Traditional list is ignorance, formations, consciousness, mind and body, six sense organs, contact, feeling, craving, grasping, old age and death, and then it comes right back around, ignorance again, and you keep going. Somewhere along the way, someone gave me this little, very pithy way of looking at it. I wish I could say thank you to this person. I don't know where it came from. Or maybe I made it up, but I don't think so. The whole thing was reduced, this whole complex chain was reduced to something simpler. From ignorance, and I'll define that in a minute. From ignorance, I make, I grab, I attach, I acquire. So from ignorance, I make, I grab, I attach, I acquire. I use this every day. So ignorance here is not a lack of information, okay? It's not checking the news and not knowing what's going on in the world. It's a different kind of ignorance. It's a deep foundational, I guess, misunderstanding or misperception of what this is. In a very specific way, what this is impermanent, meaning changing all the time, and interconnected, endlessly interconnected. For daily survival, our brains really want to create a narrative that makes sense. So we interpret the world as if it were permanent and unchanging in any given moment. But that illusion is exactly the root of all human suffering. So one way I practice with this is very simple. Because I forget, I'm ignorant. This vast interconnection and how everything's moving, it's a moving reality. Because I forget that, I start to create these rigid ideas about things. In other words, I make something, usually a story with some meaning, out of just the raw experience. And now, because there's a kind of a meaning attached to my raw experience, what do? I start having preferences. Well, I like this, and I definitely don't like that. I want things to go my way, and sorry if they're not going your way. I need them to go my way for me to be happy. And then I attach something to this whole experience. This raw experience has now got meaning, and now I attach something to it. And what do I attach? An I. I attach this distinct, separate sense of I, living inside a world that it has constructed, entirely forgetting that I helped build the house in which I am now trapped by my own ideas and opinions and preferences. Trapped I am, trying to find the door pretty regularly, or a window, or any exit. When we practice regularly, we get to watch this whole cycle over and over again, kind of in real time, not just sitting zazen, but in every aspect of our lives. We start to notice, because we spend so much time noticing here what comes up in that whole cycle, we start noticing all the time that the world that we experience through this body and mind, kind of making it up. And when we start to see that on a very regular basis, then arises the possibility of not making, not grabbing, not attaching, and not acquiring a separate identity that then has to be protected and defended all the time. This happens not because we've figured out everything and we have a nice little continuous story about our lives and the world's life, but because we have finally stopped thinking that we have to figure something out. So I'll give you an example. I can give you one that happened, or I can give you several. They come up constantly for me. One is something that just happened a few minutes ago while you were sitting. I know one person here actually experienced it pretty up close. We're sitting in the first period, and I just happened to look up for a sec. Usually my eyes are like your eyes down there. Just as I looked up, a big bird, yeah, came against that glass plate window. And I saw it coming, like, this fluttering thing, and boom, against the glass. This happens. Immediately, it's amazing how fast we interject a self here. What did that mean? I actually thought it meant something. So the raw experience is just this bird flying into the glass, but the mind goes so quickly to trying to make a meaning out of it. Another example from this week is we have some repairs going on, some construction. By the way, this whole talk is a construction, by the way, but we have some construction going on up there. So we've been sitting in the morning and in the evening with the sound of saws and power tools. And the first day this happened, I thought it was quite hilarious. I was laughing, thinking, well, now let's see what your practice is like, because you're sitting here quietly and this went on. It was pretty funny. But after a few minutes, you couldn't have an opinion that this is bad or this is good because you would not be in your exact experience. After a few minutes, that went away and you're just sitting, and that's just like a bird sound. It's just another sound without any extra weight, no story that it's good or bad, just a sound. But the big experience I had with this, I'm calling it a big experience for the first time, was sitting here, as we do twice a day, looking at a wall. And suddenly, in the middle of my zazen, comes waltzing my grandfather and my grandmother and my father and any little array of long gone people whom I love. And also, my not yet born grandchildren. I'm sitting here and they're all waltzing through my zazen. The experience was I was 4-year-old again. I felt my body with my pixie haircut and my little small strong little body, and my grandfather was slipping me some candy. And then I was 15 years old, sitting next to my grandmother, who's probably then my age now. And I was stroking her arm and I was telling her, I really love her arm. Always smelled like Jergens lotion, kind of almond. I was stroking her arm and saying, I love your old skin, which now I'm wearing, by the way. And she was, it's terrible old skin. Like, I love this skin. So soft. Then I was back in my 6-year-old body. I was sick when I was a little girl. I was in the hospital and I woke up, and my father, a cardiologist, had his hand on my heart right here. And I was feeling it right again. I can still feel his hand there. Then, as I mentioned, my yet unborn ch grandchildren, neither of my son's wives are pregnant, but yet I saw this person as an older person holding these babies. One after another, they appeared. It was all so tender and sweet and kind of without any barriers. And it struck me that you could, in retrospect, say that I was just imagining and fantasizing and not doing a very good job being in the moment. But somehow, in that moment, there wasn't a separation of time from then and now and the future. For a little bit of time, this ordinary structure about time was loose, very loose. I didn't feel that there was a past me and a present me and a future me, or any of these people were anywhere but in this kind of dimensional time. It wasn't a sense of a timeline, not this way, but this way. No time separate. There's a whole fascicle by Dogen called Uji that covers this, but there it was right in my lap. So I felt that the past wasn't behind me, and the present wasn't here, and the future wasn't over there. They were all present within the same field at the same time. And in that field, there was no sense of this self experiencing it. It was an unlocatable self. There wasn't a separate me standing outside looking at this. I embodied all of it at the same time somehow. And there was no sense that I had to be a separate me either. Just this kind of endless, vast unfolding of causes and conditions and relationships and memories and bodies and lives. It felt like a big relief. Like, whew. And I did not try to make any meaning or make a narrative about this at all. And then the bell rang. And immediately some words popped into my mind. And I'm going to ask you to repeat them with me in just a minute, but because they're so short, I just want to know how you feel about them. And maybe you'll take them with you and use them. The words were, so this is how it is. Can we do that together? So this is how it is. This is how it is. This, in any given moment by moment by moment, this is how it is. So this is how it is right now. How is it right now? This is how it is. Not good, not bad, just how it is. And then after those words popped into my mind, like a little caption for the whole sit, so this is how it is. I stood up, straightened my zabuton, I made some grateful bows, and I started thinking about coffee and breakfast. And that is how it is, too. This feels like the most important part of this story, the coffee and the breakfast. The experience came. It didn't last. I couldn't grab it. I couldn't do anything with it. It changed. I couldn't hold on to it. And then it was over and it was time for coffee and breakfast. And in fact, I haven't mentioned this story to anyone, even my partner, because I was afraid I would hold on to it. But I guess maybe I am. So I'm telling you about it. I can tell you about it now. I can make a profound story about this. I can decide that it means something monumental about my incredible practice. And I can also notice that very impulse to do that, to make a story. There I go again, out of my ignorance, making. grabbing, attaching, and acquiring. Another story about who I am, what reality is, and what's going on. So our practice is actually noticing this tendency all the time, how the mind is always reaching to try to make sense, and how we can gently let go. And this is where the Buddha's story come back to me. So I mentioned that later on, after the Pali Canon, this is the version I'm going to talk about right now, is kind of the non-canonical version, so the Mahayana version later yet. So in the Zen kind of telling of the Buddha's awakening, the Buddha says something when he's awakened. He has this beautiful expression of his realization. He says, there are many versions of this. This is the one you get today. I and all beings and the great earth together attain the way. I hear this as the fact the Buddha is pointing out that awakening isn't the Buddha's solo achievement. How could it be? If everything is interdependent, there is no Buddha awakening separately from you right here, right now, in this kind of multi-dimensional space of time being. My liberation is not about me. My awareness is not about me. My suffering is not about me. And by me, of course, I mean you. We. The earth itself isn't separate from us. So letting go is not this withdrawal from everything. Look what I've done. I've let go. It's actually entering life more intimately, more completely, because there's less a sense of a me separate from we. Less of me trying to make, attach, you get it. The issue with making and creating this identity that is separate is then you spend an enormous amount of energy having to protect it and defend it. So even at the age of 16, at the tender age of 16, I think I had a whiff that I wasn't going to really ever going to grasp who this is and what's going on. Not completely, maybe moment by moment, but not like this narrative that says, this is the meaning of my life and life. I understood my basic ignorance. And I think I understood it not in a negative way. I think I continue to understand ignorance in a way of awe and wonder at the interconnection and the endless changing nature of reality. It's not to say that I don't often desperately try to create a story of me that has some continuity, but it doesn't really work. And I was not some kind of teenage Buddhist savant. I really was not. I had simply noticed that my mind could create a story, one explanation after another, and I could easily become attached to those explanations and make them about me. One thought leads to another, one desire leads to another, one story leads to another story. And before we know it, we believe our stories, and then we're trapped in the house. We are caught in a world that seems terrifyingly rigid and cold, and we forget that we help construct it. We forget that we can let go. Fortunately, the Buddha's story reminds us we don't have to carry around these stories. They show us the fears and the doubts and the insecurities and the expectations and the projections that we have to wrestle with. And they're no different than the ones Siddhartha sat down with. Maybe a little different, but not significantly. So Siddhartha, when he sat down under that tree, sat down with the intention, as I mentioned, to wake up, to see the root of all human suffering, to see everything exactly as it is. In the Mahayana version of his awakening, there's this personification of his fears and doubts, in kind of a cinematic version of the Buddha's awakening. The name of this being is Mara, Mara, Mara. And this is a personification of everything that he's worried about. Mara shows up in successive little times in the Buddha's life after this episode as well. But here he shows up representing the exact ways that the Buddha's mind tried to pull him out of the present moment of his intent and his resolve to wake up. So first, Mara sends in an army of demons, let's call them demons, and he throws them at Siddhartha, and Siddhartha just tolerates it, does nothing about it, just sits through it, watches it like you watch when you're watching your life arise while you're sitting. And because he does not fight them, try to grab them or get rid of them in any way, these demons or materials, things that are being thrown at him, they dissipate midair and they fall down as flowers around him. So suffering is transformed into flowers. Then Mara sends daughters, these three daughters. It's always these women, trouble. Sends three daughters to seduce Siddhartha. They represent craving and aversion and passion. They try to seduce him, to pull him into wanting or rejecting. But again, he does nothing but observe. He doesn't grasp and he doesn't push them away. He simply stays with his discomfort and they dissipate. Finally, Mara attacks Siddhartha directly. Who do you think you are? What right do you have to sit in this seat of awakening? And says, who will testify that you belong here? And instead of fighting or arguing or pulling out a diploma or a list of credentials of all the things he's passed with all these prior teachers over 6 years, he puts his hand on the ground. This is called the earth touching mudra. And he calls upon the earth. You could say the earth goddess, she has a name, doesn't really matter. He calls upon the earth, witness, to witness that he has the right to be in this seat. And so the earth goddess appears to bear witness to his countless lifetimes of good deeds and practice. And finally, Mara calls it a day and quits. I really love the fact that the earth goddess appears, that the earth is the witness. You know, when you see us bowing, we are touching earth. We are touching earth. I like it because awakening into your own life is not achieved by escaping the world. It's achieved by being in the middle of this dusty, muddy, messy life together. Everyday life. So you can see that this is like a psychological map. Mara, you have yours, I have mine. Mara is whatever shows up to convince us that we have to hold on to something fixed, that we have to hold on to something that makes sense and that has some continuity and that won't change. For example, Mara shows up as fear that says, you're in danger. You can't trust. Or Mara shows up as craving that says, you're not going to be happy unless you have this. Or maybe Mara shows up as aversion definitely got to get this out of your life. Or Mara shows up as this kind of endless chattering voice in your head that says you're not good enough. Koban, Chino, Otogaro Roshi, the founder of this temple, called that the little policeman. It's whispering, you're not enough. You're not good enough. You don't belong here in the seat of your own awakening. So the ego tells us to fight these voices, right? To fight them, that we need to defend some self. And so we fight. We fight our anger, we fight our desires, we try to deny our experience. We try to kill off the parts of ourselves that we don't like. We fight reality itself. We refuse to agree with what's right in front of us if we don't like the story, because it doesn't match our ideas about ourselves. But Siddhartha did not fight Mara. You notice he did not once fight Mara. He did not defeat Mara by becoming stronger or angrier. He just sat. I like to call this in my own practice tolerating my discomfort. He just tolerated his discomfort so that he could see it for what it was. He didn't take the bait of his own stories. And in that moment, all of that became flowers. Everything that was coming at him was transformed. So this is the radical practice of letting go. It is not forcing something away. It is not rejecting. It is not denying. It is not making ourselves into some kind of new shiny spiritual being. Letting go is not winning against reality. Letting and letting go is simply, this is how it is. This is how it is. In this breath, this is how it is. It will be different in the next breath. This is how it is through this body and mind, through this body and mind. This is how it is. Just seeing and then watching and seeing the making, seeing the grabbing, seeing the attachment, seeing the identity, and then letting go. This is being awake. So, as I practice with this little special version of the 12 links of origination, remember ignorance. Out of ignorance, I make, I grab, I attach, I acquire. I personally practice every day with letting go of what I have made up. I do this when I'm sitting, zazen. I do this when I'm walking. I do this when I'm talking. I do this when I'm talking to myself, which you do more and more of as you get older. I do this while I'm grieving loss. I do this when I'm enjoying. And the practice gets really, really rich when I feel defensive. Because there's something, there's an identity I've attached, and now I got to look at that. This is me facing my Maras. I welcome them. I welcome them. I see how they help me see how it is. Letting go does not mean becoming indifferent. It does not mean not caring. If we become numb to our own suffering, we become numb to everyone's suffering. If letting go makes us indifferent, it isn't letting go at all. Letting go, there's nothing left but compassion. It pours in. True letting go is probably the definition of compassion. Letting go does not mean we stop making choices and that we're not responsible for our choices or that we should become passive. Letting go actually is the opposite direction. It becomes more intimate, closer, because we've let go of our rigid ideas, our plans for who we are in this big scheme. And instead, we just meet each moment as it arises, being upright, transparent, really deeply truthful, not holy, just completely ordinary. His Holiness the Dalai Lama calls any kind of self-promotion a self-deception. I have a crush on the Dalai Lama. Just no question about it. So this letting go is a loosening of the grip. It's a humble admission of something that I knew when I was 16. I'm never going to get a total grip on who this is or who anybody else is, what should happen, what just happened, and what might happen next. What happens instead is I notice things happen. I have an experience through this body and mind, raw experience. But it doesn't need to be solved. That experience is not a problem that needs to be solved. Even if I'm totally bewildered, which I am pretty regularly, doesn't need to be fixed. I can tolerate that discomfort and see what happens next with the kind of curiosity, because I cannot know. So just like Siddhartha, we sit down wherever we are and we meet ourselves, including our own Maras. We sit and tolerate our discomfort and watch the things that are difficult become flowers, gifts. We touch the earth. We discover that when we stop trying to make a big narrative story with meaning that makes it make all sense, we don't have to hold these fabricated selves together. Absolutely nothing falls apart when we let go of that. There is just this, all of us together, this. Even when we are afraid to trust each other, be together. Even when we completely surrender to the joy of being together without having to impose a separate self. This is how it is. So thank you for listening. And this is how it is when you get to ask questions or make comments or express concerns. In other words, it's your turn.
What do you think the role of art is in? Or this is how it is.
The question is, I'm just repeating this, what do you think the role of art is in this is how it is? Well, I was just having this conversation this morning. This is how it is, art and music, not just our conventional ideas of art, right? Anything that we create without a desire to be recognized. Just kind of the art could just be the expression of the experience without a desire for it to make sense. You with me? Without a desire for it to have meaning. It can be just this, and there are lots of artists in this room, so maybe some of you would like to speak to this. Maybe we're all artists in this room, huh? But just the expression of the experience without the need for it to mean something or demonstrate something or fix something or be seen as something. I think that's one way I would look at it. There are probably other ways. Any artists want to respond?
Thank you.
I have question. One sec, there's somebody there. Go ahead.
Does Mara grow as your sense of this grows?
Does Mara grow as your sense of this is it
This
grow?
is it.
I don't know if Mara grows. I think there's an endless supply of Mara so far. I don't know if it's getting bigger. Does Mara grow? Does Mara grow as your awareness of this is just how it is grow? I don't know if it grows. That's an interesting question. My own experience, and maybe you can answer this from your experience, is that there's just an endless opportunity because we've been really conditioned to feel separate. So every time there's a self to defend, there's a Mara to address. And every time there's a sense that I need it to stay like this, meaning it shouldn't change, or it should change, there's a Mara to address. So I don't know if it grows. Maybe your sensitivity to the awareness, oh, there's another Mara, grows. I would say that's awareness. And that definitely gets kind of tuned. That's why this is a practice and not a once and done. But yeah, I would say that's the way in which it's not that Mara outside of us or our issues get bigger. You could say they shrink because we become aware of the whole making process.
So, I had a question about how to get along with our ego, and sometimes how to let the ego let it go.
Did you hear that? Okay, the question is how to get along with our ego and how to let the ego let it go.
Maybe this is my intuitive question from your talk about your experience about your life, and sometimes the intuitive from my body. I just think about the ego. We always fighting with the ego, and we always defensive with the ego. So make a trouble, make some problem, and the mind sometimes control your something like that. So like your experience when the ego or like some of the shadow came out.
That's exactly what the Siddhartha was doing when he sat down, right? He faces Mara, the personification of his projection, fears, doubts, insecurities. And that's ego, And what does he do? Doesn't fight them. He doesn't try to beat them into submission. He observes. He observes and he develops this incredible kind of unmovability by of being able to bear it, tolerating it. Just seeing it is a huge step. And the way that in my own life, the way I see it is through my body. Like I don't, it doesn't get up registered in my brain until after I've noticed it in my body. My body's feeling some discomfort, and it's an awareness like, what is that? What is that? What's going on? What's happening? And who's it happening to? It's, I've said this many times. In my experience, it's never the person sitting here. So I would say that when you feel that there's something to defend or something to fight, you have to notice that happening and not necessarily defend and fight. Stop. Take a breath. Take a walk. Absolutely do not speak in that moment. You will hurt yourself. You will hurt others. Do not speak. Let the whole nervous system calm down. For me, I go for a walk. I have to go for a walk. I have to keep my mouth closed. And I observe what I've created, the story I've created, and I try not to kill it. I try to let it teach me. So I would say to turn your whole system upside down. Instead of thinking the ego is something to fight, see the ego is your teacher. Every single time you feel you got to go Go. You try? Me too. Yes, Shoho.
Coming back to that question, did you phrase it? Does Mara grow?
Yeah, he did ask, does Mara grow with your understanding?
Does Mara grow with your understanding? As your understanding
No, does Mara grow? Does Mara grow? Do all the projections grow as you begin to notice that you, am I right? You want to
Yeah,
repeat?
the question was, does Mara grow as sense of this is it grows? Besides what you said, and perhaps you can expand on this, but it occurred to me with that question that in one sense Mara does grow, but not Mara, Mara herself or itself, but the effects of Mara grow. Because what happens with this practice, and it's not something we make, like you said, talk about making, it's something that happens naturally. With this letting go that Nenzer talked about, naturally arises a sense of interconnection or non-separation with all of life. And with that non-separation, naturally comes passionate response. So they say, from the arising of wisdom, passion naturally arises. So I would say that not in response, I would say that Mara doesn't grow, but you notice more the effects of Mara in yourself and in others, and naturally you become. You know the image of Avalokiteshvara, who has many heads, and here's the, it's very sensitive to the cries of everyone who's suffering. So I would say one of the effects of meditation is you'll unavoidably become more sensitive and more compassionate, and that will happen with this awareness and this letting go that Zen talks.
Thank you. What Shoho was speaking to was the first question, or one of the early questions about does Mara grow as your awareness of, so this is it grow? And he said that the effects of that grow so that you become more and more compassionate. And I want to say, actually, because this is very alive for me, that in my own life, that this sensitivity and compassion is an interesting animal, because if you feel other people's suffering, or you notice what's happening is suffering, there's this tremendous compassion, and you have to also then say, this is how it is. It's not a project that you get to go fix them. You don't get to use your deep compassion to make them into a project that should be solved. You have to bear witness to their suffering through your compassion. And this is hard, folks, because you see when you have a heart full of compassion that, oh my gosh, a 1 degree shift and they would feel liberated from this. If they could just trust, if they could just open their hearts, they'd be fine. But that's not your job, and it's not even true necessarily. So that this is how it is has to apply to other people's experience. You can't use your compassion to try to fix anybody, okay? Some of us are fixers. I'm a recovering fixer.
I have a question regarding, I found it like one, I'm with myself, practicing this as is, Sometimes, let me rephrase it. When I'm practicing essays, just being with myself, being on my cushion, the work feels easier.
The work feels easier.
I don't know if the easier, if the word easier is the right word, but I'm going to use that.
Okay.
Yeah.
When you're practicing with yourself,
Yeah.
the work feels easier.
Not the work, but like just like being able to be
To
with
be,
it,
your
just be.
existence feels more tolerable.
Yeah. Not necessarily. Let me maybe finish my
Okay, go
question
ahead.
and then maybe appear. However, when there's a need of expressing it, sharing that, responding to things, or responding to another people's inquiry about your experience of this, that's the there's a subtle moment of I often observe it, like as I speak, there's that ignorance, arrogance, and wanting to grasp the tears. And that's the moment. There's a very subtle moment of discomfort. Sometimes I stop myself, sometimes I just continue to be autopilot, not necessarily autopilot, but like let myself to express because there's a need. But I think I struggled, I almost struggled, or I thought about it afterwards almost all the time about, because I feel like there's almost only two ways. One is responding, continuously responding, and be with my ignorance, the feeling of like the discomfort of ignorance, arrogance. And the other way is just like not talking at all. And I feel like not talking at all is probably not also not an option, or it's not the most natural state of being as well. Because just like that lady mentioned about art, sometimes I write things, I make things just because of the pure, it comes from pureness. But it's at the moment, at the gate of like sharing it out to be published, to be, you know, like to really express. At the moment, there's really a strong discomfort and arrogance again, like ego rises again. And there's, I often kind of struggle at that boundary. And it was so interesting, as you mentioned, you were sharing the story that you don't know if sharing it is actually for touching or
Yes.
expressing. I resonate with it. So I wanted to, yeah, it's I guess it's a conclusion I'm still wrestling with and still practicing, but I definitely don't want to answer, don't want to hear you say.
Thank you so much. The question concerns the awareness of being having a pure or raw experience and being kind of non-assessing and non-judgmental and being just with it. And then when she is asked to kind of, I would use the word produce something out of it, like share her experience or demonstrate something. She notices this arrogance and this kind of like, well, this being emerges that she doesn't know how to address. Sometimes she lets herself be that arrogant person and do it. Sometimes she feels she should just clamp down. And neither approach, it seems like there's not a way other than these two approaches, which is squelching and not offering herself at all. Or being arrogant and wanting to be seen. And this is your koan, my friend. It's a very, very fertile place to practice. I wish the whole world were practicing with you right there. It's very kind of poignant, right? We see that we have this pure, wholesome experience, and we have a pure wholesome desire to share it because we're interconnected. There's nothing wrong with that impulse. It's like, look, but it's not look. It's a very different kind of feeling. And I gotta say, from my heart to yours, that we are conditioned to ask for recognition. Everybody in this room has long breastfed basically on the idea that we have to be seen as an individual and that look how special we are. It's endless. It's endless. But you have this awareness already This is huge. This awareness that there is somebody who wants to be seen for maybe a reason that doesn't feel quite so selfless. And I think this is a beautiful place to be. I know it's not so comfortable, and I'm sorry. It's not comfortable for anybody, but you have the strength and the courage to even just see that is huge. And now you get to practice with this question. Who is it? Who is it that wants to be seen? Who is that one? Who didn't feel seen? And this is something that I don't know if everybody on the planet experiences, but I think it's a fair bet to say most of us do. The Buddha did. So you're in good company. Thank you for your courage in sharing that. Okay, I just want to check online and then you, and then I think that's going to be the last question. Anybody have anything that they would like to express?
I just want to, may I put a fun twist on your experience of timelessness that before we closed, that I think at that moment your self turned into a photon because photon doesn't experience any time. It's everywhere and nowhere at the same time. And according to block universe model, everything that's going to happen has already happened. So you could actually go back and forth between your past and your future. That's just a fun fact.
Well, now I have a new identity. I don't know how to work with this. I'm a photon.
Well, just try to be like a photon more.
I'll try it. I don't think I tried to get there, but I really love it. So thank you. I'm going to think about photons a lot now. Yes, Michael.
I just had a realization. Listen to this. I've always wondered what this Myra thing is, you know.
Mara.
Mara, right. Mara. It's just ego. That's all it is. I mean, I always thought it was like, okay, what is this? Some kind of the creeping religion in here with the devil and all that. It's just simply ego, right?
Yeah, good.
Now, thank you for that.
Thank you for that.
Tenzin-san, I'd like to thank you so much for so many different ways of looking at letting go. Letting go is such a misunderstood term. I'm going to be chewing on your explanations for a long time. Thank you.
Tenzin-san, please write me and tell me what happens when you chew on them.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear that.
I really appreciate seeing you, hearing from you, and please write me and tell me what happens as you chew.
Okay, I will. Okay. Thank
You.
you.
Okay, one more, and then we got to go to cookies and tea. After the beginning instruction?
Yeah. We're the king or
Queen of your domain.
driver of this map, and we'll try to position ourselves here to be in control. So I try to ask, who is the I that sits on
Sho, this is a good question for you. She's saying that in beginning instruction, you told each person that you are the king or the queen of your domain, that you're driving this bus, that you're driving this Buddha bus, and
Even that all that many people would do. You're driving your own car.
right, okay, not a bus. You're driving your Zabuton.
You have to steer.
And so she asked, please direct it to him.
Yeah, who is that?
Speak up. My hearing is not so good.
Who is the I that is sitting on the back or the driver?
Who's
Who's the?
driving? Yeah.
You.
Huh?
Yes, she said, who's the I that's driving?
Who is the I that's sitting on the cushion?
Yeah. Or who is that that you try to let us sit on? Because there's Mara and there's, as it is, there's Buddha.
Who Who is the I that is asking the question? Who is the I? It's not there.
So I don't know if you heard the question. It's a great question. They're all great questions. Shoho Roshi, in beginning instruction, told the students that when you're sitting, you're in charge. You're the king or the queen of this little domain, and you're driving. And this practitioner asked, well, who is that I who's driving? And Shoho responded, who is the one right now asking the question about who's driving? Who is the one is a big question. Okay, dear friends, we'll have more time to talk and up above if you'd like to. It's wonderful to practice with you. Thank you. We're going to do a closing chant.
Thank you for listening to this podcast offered by Jokoji Zen Center. Our Dharma talks are offered free of charge, and this is made possible by the donations we receive. Your support helps us to continue to offer the Dharma. For more information about Jokoji, please visit us on the web at jokoji.org.